Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of The Good, The Dan, The Florida Man. This is episode 42, and with you, as always, your hosts.
I'm Ryan, I'm The Good.
I'm Dan, and I'm The Dan.
It creeps me out every time you just do that.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Ben, and I'm The Florida Man, and you're listening to... this is episode 42 of The Good, The Dan, Florida Man. This is your first time listening to us. Thanks for joining us. We are three stand-up comedians that turned to a podcast after the world got shut down due to COVID, and we wanted to keep that creative comedy muscle going, and we became friends, so we started doing this. We are still stand-up comics, though, so we still have shows coming up. Ryan, where can they catch you?
You can go to college. You can catch me there. I think I'm doing a whole bunch of colleges coming up.
You actually just did a big thing, too.
I did, yeah. So when this is released, I'll have just done my comedy special. I'll have done Girlfriends and Girlfriends, two shows, St. Louis, Missouri. It was great, we think.
Probably. It better be, or I'm burning down St. Louis, Missouri.
Wow.
Okay, I'm not going to do that. Just for legal reasons, it wasn't me.
It was just for not to get inciting a riot charges.
On the off chance that St. Louis, Missouri catches on fire.
It's actually pretty common.
After this, yeah. It wasn't me. I was here.
He was here.
This is his alibi. They're going to check the day
ahead. I'm in Florida on the 12th.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm in Boca Raton, Florida on the 12th.
Boca Raton. What about you, sweet, sweet Dan? What do you got going on?
I just do what Ben does, so I'm going to have the time over to Ben at this point.
He just said the podcast. He's like, we just do what Ben does.
Oh, man. Okay, so I have some shows coming up in May. Today, when this episode comes out, I'll be in Boca Raton, Florida. At the Boca Black Box. But after that, I'm taking April off because my therapist recommended it to me. Yeah. I'll be May 19th. I'll be in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at Summit City. May 20th and 21st. I'll be in Appleton, Wisconsin, at the Skyline Comedy Club. And then May 22nd, I'll be in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Louisville Comedy Club. That's really the only soon upcoming things that I have coming up. So catch me and probably Dan at any of those.
Or corporate events in Utah, apparently. Yeah. I do a lot of those now.
Those businesses love it when other people call themselves gay. HR doesn't like it when they do it. this episode is a history episode and a topical one at that. Ryan, take us away on your trip down ridiculous history. Also, real quick. I'm going to be eating during this because I took my ADHD medicine today, and it's starting to wear off, so I'm getting hungry. We are not sponsored by Chick-fil-A. However, it is cheap and down the street.
I love that both Dan and Ban and... Oh, dang it, I couldn't even say words.
Ban and Dan
held it up there, like, just... Versus there's me that was like, I was told I need to talk during this one, so there's no food for you, boy.
Ryan also specifically told me to keep Chick-fil-A out of the shop.
I did. I said,
so was that an act of rebellion?
Because here's
then?
The thing.
You're like, I'm going to do it now because Ryan told me not to.
Some people, of course it was.
Some people get offended by it, and I'm just always like,
You have a gay guy on the podcast, right?
I know, and that's what's confusing is somehow I'll still be homophobic. Like, Ben will be fine.
You can take that heat if you want it, because I'm going to say it wasn't me.
Right, I know, that's the thing. I love that you got a gay guy.
This homophobia tastes good.
It's double breaded.
That's one of my favorite TikToks I've ever seen. It's a guy, he's very clearly gay, goes to Chick-fil-A. He's like, fine, I want to see what people are saying about this Chick-fil-A, if it's good or not. And then he just takes a bite and he goes, oh, no, because it's so good. And then he goes, well, that was not worth it, I'll tell you that. And then he sips, and it's just like an empty sound of the lemonade. It was so good. Great comedy. Yeah, today we're doing Ryan's Ridiculous History, and we're going to be talking about the history of Ukrainian defenses, actually, very specifically. So
I wonder how this topic came up.
Yeah, it happened by, so when this is getting filmed, I had been doing I started a new thing called Untimely News, where I do things about world events, and man, the world decided, hey, I remember saying in mid-January thinking, man, I just need the world to have more news, and you know what? I regret it.
Why would you say that?
I regret it so heavily.
You have Adderall, so.
Yeah, now I can think better. So now I don't say things like, I wish the world had more news, and then Russia invaded Ukraine.
You hear that, folks? It's Ryan's fault.
No!
He did it.
Ryan hates women and you.
No, I love you. I knew it was coming.
Shaggy once said, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me. likes, man. It wasn't me. Anyway.
Not the Shaggy crossover I am.
Right. I really want to sing It Wasn't Me as Shaggy. Here's what we're going to talk about today. Ukraine's a very interesting country because it was essentially refounded in 1991 when the Soviet Union fell apart. So in 1991, I believe it's November 8th or December 8th, one or two, the Soviet Union falls apart. Mikhail Gorbachev steps down, which is a crazy moment, by the way.
Is this
also
before or after he tore down the wall?
After. The wall falling down in Germany was in 1989.
What year is this?
1991.
I was close.
You're in the ballpark. Oh, yeah, no, it's very close. Well, not only that, but, like, so the leading up to the Soviet Union falling apart has, like, hardline communists kidnapping Gorbachev and being like, you will be more communist. And then you've got, like, Yeltsin and his group of, like, democratic fighters recapturing Gorbachev and being like, you can do whatever you want, man. Like you're good. Like,
yeah, that's very Boris Yeltsin of him.
Yeah, it's very. Also, during this time,
I'm
going
to fight people to capture this guy so he can just do whatever he wants.
So he can get his stuff back. Like, Boris Yeltsin also, like, he was in charge of Russia during the 90s, and it was part of something called the Wild 90s in Russia, which is where you get all of these classic ideas of Russia, like the vodka drinking, like, gopniks, which are also the terms used for, like, the gangsters. And that's where the tracksuit, like, joke and kind of, like, ideology comes from, is because they were knockoffs, and sometimes they were even better. It's weird. It's very weird. That's not what we're here to talk about, though, today. They were talking about how Ukraine forms its own government right after that, and when the USSR falls, they have, I kid you not, is someone correcting me? I'm not sure. In fact, you know what? Let me pull it.
I will not be correcting you.
It's either 1,700 or 17,000.
That's a big correction, Ryan.
I know. That's why I need to see this.
Commas are tricky. You ever read Flowers for Algernon?
No,
I was right. It's 1,700. Okay, I just need to make sure. It was 17.
I'm really proud of you.
1,700 warheads were left in Ukraine. Now, by the way, nuclear warheads. Let's talk about explosive capabilities of that. Most of them were around 50 kilotons or could have been more. So like 50 to 400. Just to put into perspective, the original one that was dropped on Hiroshima, which is, can we talk about that? That's kind of a messed up metric that everyone uses. Is like, what was the Hiroshima?
But that was actually the question I was going to have, was like, compare that to Hiroshima, because I need to know, like, how big of a bomb we're dealing with.
Yeah, and the other thing is, what else are we going to compare it to, Ryan?
Yeah.
Megatons, like, kilotons.
Well, what is that? I don't know these words.
It's kilotons of TNT. So that's 1,000 tons of TNT. So when
ton is 2,000 pounds.
Yeah, so 2,000 pounds. So just to put it like this, the bomb was dropped.
2 million pounds.
2 million pounds? Is it?
1,000 times 1,000 is a million.
What are we talking about? Hold on, wait.
A kiloton. 1 kiloton is 2 million pounds.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's 2 million pounds. And so the one that was dropped on Hiroshima was 15 kilotons. That's one of the smallest nukes that's ever been dropped.
And how many did they find in Ukraine back in the 90s?
1,700.
1,700 kilotons?
No. 1,700 nuclear warheads. And that kilotonnage stretched anywhere from 50 to 400 kilotons.
Wow.
So, at the very least, more than 3 times the power of Hiroshima. That's the smallest one.
Like, the smallest ones were like, yeah, about, well, no, 25. So, about like 1.8 or something like that.
You said 50.
Oh, sorry, 25.
25.
Crazy. I just don't know how we can trust you when you say other things.
That's fair. My bad. These warheads were wild. It's just, and so, yeah, so that should put things into perspective that, this is...
Do you
this
have
is, this
info is, on any of the particular warheads?
Yeah, so they had 130...
Did they have names?
UR-100N intercontinental ballistic missiles.
You just have to say that in English.
Essentially, a big rocket that can go hit anywhere in the world wherever it wants in about 8 minutes. Yeah.
Damn. Okay.
I think it was 8 to 16 minutes is
That's
most of their
scary.
Travel times.
Has that has that improved since then?
Nothing about what I'm going to talk about today has improved. I mean in a good way. Things have gotten faster.
Yeah.
Flying capabilities are pretty much stuck at where they're stuck at. Like, planes cannot go faster than they go right now.
Physics.
No.
I mean,
for real. Like, we have reached max speed for planes.
I thought you were talking about general planes, because most general planes can go faster. It's just that we have achieved top with some things. You know what I mean? Like, we just don't fly them a lot. Like, for instance...
Like, passenger planes?
Yeah.
That's it. That's the passenger going. They're not getting faster.
Well, the Concorde.
The flight of?
No. Okay, so the Concorde was a passenger plane that used to go over, like, Mach 2. And it used to go from, like, New York to London in 3 hours. It exploded.
Yeah.
Oh, what?
But it used to do
that. I remember it getting... Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm trying to say it's like, yeah, things go faster now.
We did. We got it go faster, and then it blew up. No idea why it would...
By the way, the ICBMs had 6 warheads each on them. So we've got, you also have 46 RT Mulodets ICBMs, which had 10 warheads apiece, and these were loaded onto trains. So they were like autonomous train launching nuclear weapons. And then they had 33 heavy bombers as well as multiple nuclear silos. By the way, a couple things about this. They also were using technology that the Russians still use today that the United States just actually stopped using. It's called MIRV technology. MIRV stands for Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicles. And so what they can do is if you shoot one missile, but because it's got MIRV technology.
Yeah, reentry being that it could just, you could send it back up again. Kind of like what they were trying to do with the Blue Falcon Space Force. Or not Space Force, but Tesla. Or, yeah,
not,
Elon
no.
Musk's kind of thing where he can reuse the rockets.
No, not that. Unfortunately, at all, because that would be cool. What MIRV is if you launch one missile, when they get to a certain height, all 10 deploy and become autonomous. So they all have the ability to target different things. So if you hit something above the United States, you could have something hit Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, Nashville, Atlanta, New York, probably like most of the East Coast in just one. So that's the power of MIRV.
Wow.
Which is crazy. So the Russia actually still works with that technology today. The United States stopped using it in around 2004.
I feel like there's men named MIRV.
There are men named MIRV.
MIRV or Marv, definitely.
Marv. Yeah, definitely Marv.
Definitely Marv.
There has to be a couple MIRVs out there.
A few MIRVs, right?
A few MIRVs.
MIRV, we hate you. That's all I'm trying to say.
MIRV, you're too powerful. Please
MIRV, we don't like how you spread yourself so thin and then you attack cities.
I don't like the beginning of that sentence. We don't like how you spread yourself, MIRV.
Please stop spreading yourself.
There were a couple like rocket groups in Ukraine that were in charge of these. That's the entire 43rd Rocket Army, 19th Rocket Division, 37th Guard Rocket Division, 43rd Guard Rocket Division, 46th Rocket Division, and 50th Rocket Division.
So for those of you listening that don't know what any of that means, the numbers are basically just the numbers of the units that are taking care of these rockets. They have nothing to do other than just like keeping track of who does what.
Yeah.
Like in the United States Army, we still do the same thing. Like 81st Airborne, that's just your group. That's your number. That's your platoon number.
Essentially your team.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And these were spread all throughout Russia. They also had a submarine base, by the way, that had nuclear-capable submarines, which is some wild stuff to be capable of.
Back in 91.
Oh, yeah.
Good for them.
I mean... The Russians have the biggest ever nuclear submarine. It's called the Typhoon-class submarine. I don't know if this is going to be a tangent. It wasn't necessarily stationed in Ukraine. Probably could have been, but it's the longest that's ever existed, and it's got like a swimming pool on board. It's nuclear powered. It can launch like, I think, 12 nuclear ICBMs at once.
I'm sorry, it has a swimming pool on board?
It's got
board?
A swimming pool inside of the...
You
yeah.
can swim at the bottom of the ocean.
Right? Isn't Just that kind of cool?
Open the hatch, brother. Stop being a coward.
Yes, don't be that type of guy.
Go for an upward dive.
An upward dive.
Let's see how far you can go.
How long is your breath
hold? Mariana's Trench and be like, let's see how long you can last.
Yo, that would be more impressive if they got a submarine at the bottom of Mariana's Trench.
It would be very fun.
Without just collapsing upon itself.
Yes, exactly. Dude, that would be so cool.
I would go. Yes, did not immediately back me up on that one.
No, because I saw
like,
that you were.
If you want to
do
that, Ben, I at this point, I'm just like, okay, sure, do the thing that
it's,
you're.
It's kind of
like
this moment's been of like, okay.
Like, I'm sure we're gonna see Ben Brainerd at some point at the first man to swim the Marianas Trench.
To swim it?
Yeah,
you're
swim
insane.
Up.
Swim you're
up.
Insane.
Swim up.
No, sir, I would go in the submarine that is indestructible apparently, but I'm not swimming. I don't like water.
Okay.
I don't like water.
It's going to be way too cold down there. Are you kidding me?
Okay. Yeah, that's the problem. by the way, just to put into perspective, the Ukraine held about one-third of the USSR's total nuclear stockpile.
Wow.
So when they fell, they didn't get any of those weapons back, so they had a third just sitting there. But which, by the way, they should put into perspective, they had a third. So that's somewhere
of
around
the entire world or the USSR's?
USSR, which had over half.
Wow.
And also to put this
so
into perspective.
So they had 1/15th of the world's?
They were third. And if when Ukraine became a country, it was the third most nuclear weapons within any country.
They had 1/3 of 1/2.
Of over.
That's 1/6. They had 1/6 of the world's
nuclear weapons.
Wow.
Yeah. The United States had the other, like, so Russia had the other 2/3 because they got them back from Belarus and I want to say Latvia almost instantaneously. And then the United States had about the same amount, but about half. So, yeah, there was very few nuclear weapons left. And but I mean, like Ukraine, a brand new country, essentially all of a sudden has more nuclear weapons than Great Britain, France, Israel, like China. Like all of these countries immediately became secondary or tertiary to Ukraine, which is now brand new, by the way.
Like, 1991.
Yeah, 1991. It's crazy.
Did they? Let me ask you. Do you know if there's like a history of like, did they like threaten people with that initially? Were they pretty like immediately like, we're not going to use these. We don't want to do that.
So that was pretty much Ukraine's stances. Well, here's what happened is, and this is called the trilateral process, and how they ended up losing all of their nuclear weapons.
Okay, real quick. They had the nuclear weapons because of the fall of the USSR, and then so they just got divvied out to the Ukraine, or the Ukraine
they were just left there.
Of the things you could leave behind,
not a great one.
Well, no, that's got to be last like, on the list of things you'd like to.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily like
you
especially
can't really transport
after
a missile silo.
Exactly. Could you imagine being back there? You're the guy, just like a phone, wallet, keys. Man, I really feel like I'm forgetting.
Just some Russian dude.
Something's going on.
He sees it on the news. That was it. 1,700 kilotons of nuclear power.
Yeah, so Russia.
My bad, guys.
Immediately tried to get it back. They were like, hey, it'd be super great if you gave those back. And Ukraine was like, hey, it'd be super great if you didn't try to take us over again. which is going to be an ironic statement as we move forward with this timeline.
Yes.
And this was 1991?
This is 1991. Yeah, they were aware because Russia had, like, is pretty much, like, every century tried to invade Ukraine since, like, I want to say 1100.
Wow.
Yeah.
A desperate much?
Because.
Like, a desperate ex, bro.
Bro, Russia, just learn to love yourself.
He's like, you up, you up, you up, you up.
For 1100 years. Because
it's, like, the Rus and the Kievan Rus, and so they view themselves as, like, the Russians view themselves as the same as Ukraine, but Ukrainians do not view themselves as the same as Russians. And so it's just this weird distinction that, like, Russia's always like, well, that'll come back to us. Also, we're going to, we'll get more into it later on what's happening
that
currently.
That is kind of what Putin said, right? He still believes that he owns it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Because Putin, we should do like a time.
Do they teach like world history in whatever class he had to go to? Because
he was taught is communist Soviet.
Yes, that's
history.
What I was going to say. Yeah. He's definitely Soviet.
And he's very much still Soviet. And that's what he's trying to do right now is essentially put back together the Soviet Union.
Which will be very interesting because now quite a bit of it is part of the NATO.
Exactly, so. Which is what we're going to get to later on this horrific timeline.
Great.
1991. So essentially what happens is like Russia starts to negotiate with Ukraine and they're like, hey, it'd be great if you give them back. And Ukraine was like, no.
No, thank you.
And so.
You mean you want us to give you back everything that you gave us to protect ourselves initially anyway? No.
Yeah. No. And.
We're going to keep the condom thing.
It's like the Mormons just knocked.
Right. they had all these nuclear weapons, but they didn't have a nuclear weapons program in Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
So they didn't have the ability to maintain them.
Yes.
But here's the thing. They would have lasted for probably 20, 30 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't going to be something that they needed immediately. They could have started a weapons program. But Ukraine was trying to do the right thing, which is why we're in a situation today, is because Russia decided to not. Now, at the time, it was being run by Boris Yeltsin, who, weirdly enough, like, it was a complete drunk most of the time, but I love Boris Yeltsin so much compared to, like, any other Russian, like, leader in the past, 200 years, I want to go with? Like,
yeah, we never really hear the good things about them.
No, they're not, it's because it's never good. Mm. It's just always bad.
I wonder why that
know.
Is.
I loved Rasputin. I know he wasn't a leader, but...
How many times does
you have
song.
To get killed before you know that you shouldn't come back? You know what I mean?
Right. Gave us Anastasia, the Fox animated movie.
Yes,
that was great. Yeah, the musical.
That. Yes.
Gave us rah-rah Rasputin. Like, it was great. Anyway.
No, keep going.
I love the Bat song.
The Bat song. Oh, Bartok. I'm Bartok de Bet.
Yes.
It's such a good.
So good.
So good.
So wonderful.
Anyway, Ukraine is like, no, we're not going to give them back. And also, we need to figure out who's going to dismantle these. also, who's going to pay us for this? Because we deserve to get paid for this nuclear material that we have. Right. And so Russia and Ukraine kind of stalled it in 92, and that's when the U.S. came in. So in 1993, the United States comes in, because here's what the United States wants.
Knock, knock, knock. Hey, we heard you had stuff that blows up.
Yep.
Can we? Don't worry about it. We just gonna, don't, you know what? You keep doing your thing. If you just look that way for like 45 minutes and then like mow your lawn,
it'll be good.
We'll be out.
Yeah. We'll take care of it.
You won't even notice us.
Well, it's cool. You know, it was a weird moment because actually the U.S. was liked by both sides. The Russians were stoked because they knew the U.S. wanted to get them their nukes back. And the Ukrainians were stoked because they knew that they didn't like the Russians. So they were like, cool, you guys will actually be pretty great for this. So we came in to intervene. And here's what happened. And here's, you can see where
who
things
was in charge of this intervention?
Bill Clinton.
Okay.
Says nothing. Just, I think he had other things going through his head. Mostly
walks into
Monica
Russia
Lewinsky's.
With a saxophone and an assistant.
Yeah, it was. Oh, it was not. Yeah. Anyway,
an eventful year.
No, keep
1993.
Going.
Yeah. What eventful?
I was born that year.
What else happened in that year?
Bam, bam, bam. So what happened is
when did OJ go on trial?
I think it was That was 1992, right?
No, that was the LA riots, 92.
That's 92? When OJ went? Oh,
no,
the riots were 92. Yeah.
Was it not in 92?
I think so.
I thought I heard, well, I've only heard this. I need to, yeah, let's just double check. But
it was 95.
Anyway.
95?
Oh, wow. 95? Was that when the verdict happened or when the trial started?
That was when the trial started.
Okay.
But man, that's, what a wild decade.
Dude, the 90s were insane.
Like, I was born.
We were all born.
We were all born.
Yeah. We were all born.
Wow.
What a great start.
Human life was developed.
Human life.
Yeah, before us.
Three podcasters. But
before us, there wasn't.
Anyway, the U.S. comes in because here's what the U.S. wants. The U.S. wants like no new nations to be nuclear capable. They essentially want to limit as many nuclear nations as there are in the world. Uh-huh. Which, like, at the time, tracks, you don't want a brand new country to be like, guess what we got? Because they could have been North Korea. They weren't. They could have been.
Right.
Now, at the same time, they also want to give them back to the Russians, but with the express caveat that they destroy them. So, which is kind of funny. Oh. So, it's like, you can have them, but you better take them apart. And they made sure that they took them apart. So, they were like, this is a double win for us. So, the United States is like, hey, we'll come.
Hold on. I would have loved to be on that team that would oversee the Russians taking apart their babies.
Right?
Just like
after the Soviet Union fell too, they had to cry while doing
it. Yeah, the whole everything's just going so bad for Russia, and then here comes America, and Russia's like, yes, America is going to help, and then America's like, you can have them back if you take them apart with your own hands, because that seems way worse to me. Now I'm gonna watch you take apart the thing you want so bad. Mm-hmm. Oh, that'd be so. Weird jobs in history that I'd like to have. Watching the Russians take apart the one thing they care about.
That should be a series. It's just weird things in history we wish we could have done as jobs.
It's Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs, but a historical twist to it.
That would be awesome. Oh my God, I'd love
Mike
to host
Rowe's
that.
Mike Rowe's Historical Jobs.
Oh man. So anyway, by the way, in 1993, international relations theorist and University of Chicago professor John Mearsheimer published an article including his prediction that Ukraine, without any nuclear deterrent, was likely to be subjected to aggression by Russia. He was proved right while we're filming this, like 2 days ago.
Yeah, that's
true.
What year did he predict this?
1993. It's before they even gave up all of their nuclear weapons, because that'll be done in 94. So it's literally as it's happening. He's like, hey, just to let you know, this is going to happen. He was right.
You mean a country that had been educated in Soviet, I don't know, propaganda suddenly was like, oh, yeah, maybe we want this whole entire country back. Which is such an interesting, it's just so weird that people just immediately trusted right out of the gate. I know Boris Yeltsin was pretty great as a president. I mean,
but he was better than what we
are now. Personable, we should say. I'm not going to say
great,
but personable.
Yeah, he was a drunk.
He was a drunk, for sure. We have discussed in detail.
He was personable, and he was also willing to, like, come to the world stage.
Yes.
He was willing to have peaceful negotiations and talks. Unfortunately, like, what no one was expecting was the Soviet Union to essentially be tried to be revived by someone like Vladimir Putin. And no one expected Vladimir Putin, who is currently, I mean, essentially a dictator. He's the guy that he created the prime minister position so that he could not be president for a while, so that he could go back and run for president again. He's just alternating between those two positions.
And then kill all the other people running for president.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
that kind of happened in Rhode Island.
Excuse me? What?
No, you know, never mind.
Yeah.
We're going to have a fun, ridiculous history.
All right, we're
going to
talk about it. Okay. I'll give you the very brief. You would love this story. So there was a governor. His name was Buddy Cianci. It's the Italian way I pronounced it. Everyone just said Cianci. He was the mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, back in, I think, like the late 90s, early aughts. And he was the mayor for a while and then had to step down because he got charged with abducting and torturing his ex-wife's current boyfriend. He pled no contendere.
Wow.
But he had to step down for being mayor for like 4 years. And then he ran again, got elected again. And then he had to step down from that one because he got convicted of like running the mafia, basically.
Wow.
Being like the head of a criminal enterprise.
That's
wow.
crazy.
And everyone still liked him. Like, they would wear shirts that would say Free
that
Buddy.
Rhode Island has crime.
Oh, Rhode Island was founded by the mafia.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
I don't know
and
anything
they were
about
run,
Rhode Island. I have a friend, like, one of my
they
best
were legitimately
friends from Rhode Island,
run by the mafia until, like, 2011.
What?
Either the mafia or the mob, whichever one. Not sure if there's a big difference, but if there is.
So there's multiple mobs and mafias, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they were, the entirety of Rhode Island up until, like, 2011.
Wow. And they have a Friendly's there, too. No. Not a great name for a place that's run by the mob.
Yeah, the reason it's okay is because nobody in Rhode Island likes to leave Rhode Island.
And there's 40 people.
There's over a million in Rhode Island.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
They're far from the... There's more people in Rhode Island, Alaska. And Wyoming. And the Dakotas.
Wow.
Low bar.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. But there's a thing in Rhode Island where they don't, if it's more than a 15-minute drive, they don't want to.
I know, because I'm buddies with Francis. I don't know if you guys.
Oh,
know.
Yeah.
And Francis
yeah.
is like, I won't do it.
Yeah.
He was in a long distance relationship. The girl lived like 20 minutes away.
Yeah. if you talk to a Rhode Islander and you're like, wait, I got to go. It's like 30 minutes away. They're like, oh, I guess I got to pack a day bag.
Yep.
Let me grab a lunch. They hate it.
I'm going to like phone my Rhode Island friend after this and be like, you need to tell me more stuff about where you're from.
Well, you can drive through the entire state from one side to the other in 45 minutes.
I've done that.
So when your state is a 45-minute drive length, 15 minutes is just very far for you.
Yeah. I agree.
It's wild. Anyway, nukes.
Sorry about that.
No, loved it.
the fact that, we can develop missiles that can like, go from one side of the earth to the other in 8 minutes, but we can't develop like
Rhode Islanders that want to leave their state.
fun.
Yeah. So these nuclear weapons are getting exchanged, and it's going to be done by 1994. And what's going to happen is something called the Budapest Memorandum, which is going to be all the things that the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I don't know why they say it on everything, but it's very funny to me.
Now, was this before or after the Grand Hotel?
Oh, Budapest Grand Hotel? Movie? Before. Mm. Actual hotel? Probably after.
Okay. Just checking. I just wanted to make sure I have my timeline correct.
and the United States.
You're a big Wes Anderson fan. I just...
I love how proud you are of that, Ben.
Don't you judge me, Earl. Anyway,
it's the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the United States reaffirm their commitment to Ukraine, and that's how all of this is going to start. In accordance with the principles of the final act of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, to respect the independence and sovereignty of the existing borders of Ukraine.
Mm.
That's going to be important as we jump about 30 years in this timeline. Number two, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the United States reaffirm their obligation to refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of Ukraine, and that none of their weapons will ever be used against Ukraine except in self-defense or in otherwise in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. Now, this is an important thing in why Putin has been saying so much that this is a defensive war, that they're invading to protect themselves. A couple things about
that's not how that works.
No, it's not.
It's castle doctrine.
Oh my gosh, we're
you
so
went
scared.
To his Drop house.
Him. Yeah, exactly. Now, I will say a couple things about this that are really interesting is that, like, Putin is saying this, and he says that he's trying to go in and, like, free the people. Like, they've set up separatist movements in a couple regions, Luhansk and Donbass. I'm pronouncing those horrifically, by
Absolutely.
The way. I'm butchering those. And as well as in Crimea, where they essentially have Russian-supported forces that went in and pretended to be rebels and freedom fighters so that they could be like, look, they're fighting for their freedoms. We're going in. And now they've just invaded all of Ukraine. A couple things that happened that are interesting, like, just as far as
So, real quick,
Yeah.
This treaty that was signed that said they couldn't use force unless it was defensive. What is the or else portion? What
that's
happens?
That's the problem.
And there that's the no problem with or the... else it's like an open-ended?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay.
That's
very,
the problem.
Very,
with...
very United States of them to like not specify.
Well,
historical
very
job.
Of everyone.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
historical
yeah,
job. I would not have wanted.
Yeah.
The guy that has to finish the treaty.
Well, no. Good news. That job didn't exist. Clearly, you know what I mean. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah.
If
sorry.
Anything, he had the easiest job in the world. He's like, you don't want me to write anything?
All right. Right. Okay. Or else. Dot. Dot. Dot.
That's really what it is. Well, and that's why Putin right now is saying that, like, he wants to go in and to quote. This is my favorite part about the whole thing because it's just the most ridiculous and it makes me just disgustingly sick. Is that he says that he wants to go in and denazify the Ukraine, like they're not like the Ukraine is being run by neo Nazis. Do you know who their president is? Do you know what his
Jewish man, isn't he?
Yeah, he's Jewish.
Super.
Yeah, yeah, not like
what? Like one of the most.
I don't know if one of the most.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't asked.
But... Yeah, I haven't asked around either. Yeah. But yeah, he's Jewish. And wow. So there, he's going like, we need to denazify this country. And literally the president's like, I'm Jewish. What are you talking about?
Like, a big portion of the Ukraine is mm-hmm. Jewish.
Well, smaller than it used to be based on history.
Yeah, we're 90s.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. But yeah, no, a good amount of Jews, like Ashkenazi Jews, would still be in
which
that.
Is funny because then if you look at right now, wasn't there like a whole... Did you guys see the giant protest by a whole bunch of Nazis? I can't remember what was that. But
excuse
like a few days
me?
Ago? Yeah, apparently they were having...
there was
some
one
people
in
were
Orlando.
Having a book reading and a whole bunch of Nazis showed up outside and started protesting the book reading because they didn't like the way that... I think it might have been related to critical race theory. I need to double check those
remember
facts.
When you were a kid and you didn't know how to read and you would get upset at other people who knew how to read?
I still don't know how to read. Again, as evidenced by the
that's,
podcast.
That's what happens. The Nazis were jealous. They were like
you... oh, these people can read? Oh, you readers!
It's like when gay people call everyone else breeders.
Yes, yeah.
And then the Nazis was like, you readers,
yes,
you better stop.
Yeah, yeah. Gay people and Nazis, the exact same thing, I guess.
Yeah, just the one small...
Not the Gestapo.
No, it's just that you have the nickname for the people that do the thing that you don't.
Yes.
Well, theirs is reading.
It's just mind-blowing that I didn't even know about that either. I didn't hear Putin's quote about that. Mm-hmm. But it is so weird that we kind of also live in a time where Nazis have come back and made a comeback.
See, I want to take a moment and kind of expound on that a little bit. Like, I just feel like that is something that we say a lot mm-hmm. and unfortunately is way heavily...
Incorrect, like because they never left.
They never left. It's true.
Well, not even that.
I mean, they
like,
were in Alabama working for NASA. So
I mean, they were working for NASA, but like these were... When we talk about Nazis, when we talk about the German Nazis, the Third Reich, we are talking about something that is very different than what we have now, which are neo-Nazis. They are not, I mean, it's not the same. Don't get me wrong. White supremacists and very virulently evil people.
Yes.
But it is not the same. Yeah. And I feel like if we, the problem is like in America, we've called too many things Nazis that now when Putin goes, oh, we're denazifying, everyone's like, no, it doesn't hold any weight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's also like very ironic that he's like, we need to denazify by doing what the Nazis did.
Did exactly. And that's like, let's do a lightning war. That's called a blitzkrieg. Like, what are you doing? Like, but
no, it's self defense.
It is. So it is ridiculous.
All we did was instigate them a lot for a very long time.
And
what,
then they
how
didn't,
is that?
And then they didn't fall for it, so we invaded anyway.
Yeah, this is purely defensive. I'm a genius.
Yeah, it's gross.
There's some act outs I don't want to puke after doing. That's not one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think as we go through what like happens after 94, the Ukrainian like state essentially denuclearizes and they join the Treaty for the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which means that they will never try to attain nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
Which is normally a thing that like most nations are trying to be a part of because it looks very favorably upon
countries
them.
Countries that aren't a part of that?
North Korea.
Yeah. You want to take a guess?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few guesses.
Yeah.
Is America one of them?
No, we're a part of it.
We just don't make any more.
Yeah,
that was part of the caveat. Was like, can we keep the ones that we already have?
That is it. If you're a nuclear nation, you're allowed to stay a nuclear nation. Not only that, there is some things that have been done to like reduce. It's called Smart 1 and Smart 2, and mm-hmm. they're both programs to be able to denucleify.
What was that word?
Denucleify.
Okay. It just sounded, you know.
Fake?
Yep.
Yeah, it doesn't denuclearize. Ah, there it is.
Denuclearize.
Denuclearize.
Go George Bush with it. Nuclear.
Nuclear.
We're going to denuclearize.
Denuclearize. We're going to denuclearize.
I feel like George W. Bush would have said denuclearate.
Actually sounds real good.
We're going to join.
I love that word. Wow.
We're actually signing a new piece of paper today that tells us we're all going to denuclearate our nuclear weapons.
Let's see what...
Don't look this up. It's wrong.
No. I'm looking up Smart 1 and Smart 2. Also, they promised a whole bunch of other things involving, like, hey, like, if you become victims of things, like, we will step in for you.
If you are a victim of nuclearation.
Nuclearation.
Don't come crawling to me, because you're probably radioactive. But if you were able to crawl, that'd be pretty impressive. I'd be impressed. I would denuclearify you. Denute. I would denute you.
Denute you.
It's like being demoted, but it's good.
Yeah.
Ryan's just like,
I'm just like, okay.
Yes.
Move it.
Did you find the word?
No, I didn't. I wasn't looking for the word. I was looking for Smart 1 and Smart 2, which I was having trouble finding. But here, I can find it through MERV technology.
What, un-nuclearify?
I love that just Ben is just like...
Un-nuclearify.
He's just going to keep doing it until you find the word. Please find the
nuclearify it. We're gonna go in there, we're gonna nuclearify it, and it's the nuclearinator, and we're gonna take over the tri-state area.
Okay, here we go. New start. Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty is a nuclear arms reduction treaty between the United States and the Russian Federation with the formal name Measures for the Further Reduction is Limited the Limitation of Strategic Offensive Arms. It was signed on April 8th, 2010 in Prague, after the ratification entered force into February 5th, 2011, is expected to last until February 5th, 2026, and been extended in 2021. Now, what it's supposed to do, let's find out. I believe it's supposed to, New START replace the Treaty of Moscow, SORT. It was set to expire in December of 2012. It follows START 1 Treaty, which expired in December 2009, proposed START 2 Treaty, which never entered force, and the START 3 Treaty, for which negotiations were never concluded. The treaty calls for halving the number of strategic nuclear missile launchers. A new inspection verification regime will be established, replacing the SORT mechanism. It does not limit the number of operationally inactive nuclear warheads that can be stockpiled, a number in the high thousands.
Wow.
So essentially, as long as your nuclear weapons are deactivated, but they're just sitting there, that's fine.
I have a question for you, Ryan.
Yeah.
Did you figure out why you couldn't find Smart 1 and Smart 2 when you Googled it?
Yeah, because it's START. Yeah, because I'm dumb.
Yeah.
START 1 and START 2.
I feel like I remember like talking about that whole agreement in high school. Like I remember like people discussing it and being like, what does this mean for the world?
I don't remember any of that.
Nope.
Public school, Florida.
Oh.
Daytona Beach specifically.
Scary.
I barely remember reading.
Well,
granted, I did not, but it was assigned.
Was assigned. But yeah, so essentially nuclear programs are supposed to be like decreasing right now. Are they?
Yeah, who's to say?
Who really is to say?
We have no idea.
Well, the new inspection regulation committee.
SORT?
No. It was in like, the description of START. Yes. There had to be like new inspection recommendations.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're replacing the SORT mechanism.
No, they said specifically there would be...
Oh, yeah. Which is not...
Inspector Generals.
Effectively...
Go-Go Gadgets.
Been done.
Would you like to do that? We could do that.
Is that the new job? Is that the job?
We could volunteer. It's a current job. We're going to go country to country and be like, I see it. Okay, you put it down.
Us as a podcast is going to be the world leader.
We're filming the podcast in reducing nuclear weapons.
We confront all the world leaders and have you reduced it? Have you done it yet?
I would walk up and I'd say, I'm disappointed in you. And they'd like, oh.
Well, that's the weird thing is like some of these countries are like very closed off about it. So it's like the countries that we don't want to have it, or like the countries that like don't admit to having it, like they're never going to tell you how many nukes they have. Like we all know that Israel is nuclear capable. They haven't signed on to the treaty and they just claim to not be. We know that they're not telling the truth. In the same way that Iran and North Korea are like, we're not building nuclear weapons. And it's like, you're definitely building nuclear weapons.
And then we look at North Korea and go, well, not well.
That's actually true. It is kind of funny that right now you're looking at these power players and you're looking at like Russia and China. By the way, China and France both signed memorandums that were like the Budapest Memorandum that said that they would support Ukraine being autonomous. China. Wow. China has thus far, I think, come out saying that they will not rebuke Putin, which is
the opposite of what they said.
Yeah.
China's
also like, and I don't think this podcast goes out to China, so I think we're fine saying this, but like, just what a country. What a just.
And
like,
if we're honest, they are also dealing with a very similar situation in Taiwan.
They are. And so, and as Dan mentioned earlier, as we were talking about it today, they might have flown planes over Taiwan. And so this could be a precursor of like, what are they getting ready to do in
Taiwan?
I mean,
the Olympics are happening right there, and Taiwan is not allowed to be recognized as a country at the Olympics. Yep. So they're under the Olympic banner right now. And I feel like that's an important thing to look at, especially as the world reacts to Putin's actions right now. Mm-hmm. It's like, what does this mean for every other country that has kind of, one, been under those types of regimes? And does it mean that they're kind of going to repeat history, essentially? Yeah.
Well, and it's the question of, for these littler countries that don't have nuclear weapons, what do we do now?
Yep.
Because nothing's going to be able to... A couple countries that are under the NATO banner feel safe. Lithuania, Moldova...
Poland.
Poland. Poland especially. Poland's had, obviously, a rough history throughout, like, extended time.
What? Poland?
Yeah. What? Poland?
No.
On the upside, if there is going to be any good news coming out of this, as currently, we're only a couple days into the Ukrainian invasion, so we don't know how this is going to play out. What we can say is that Russia does have a long history of losing fights to smaller countries.
Yeah.
And so that should be really encouraging, especially because they also don't have the will to keep fighting right now. A lot of Russian soldiers are being captured, and it looks really bad.
And the Russian people also are protesting.
Exactly. They are protesting.
In mass.
And being arrested in mass.
Yeah.
Which is a huge problem.
But all you need is 3%.
And it's like, all you need is 3%, and you're fine.
It depends on how much percentage the military makes up. And how much?
Yeah, but how much? What percent of that military
will revolt?
I saw a theory, and maybe this is just like, I don't know how substantiated it is, but we talk about Putin being a Soviet and being very passionate about Soviet ideals.
Yes, very much so.
There's the theory that potentially he wants Poland because of the embarrassing nature to their revolt and separation from the USSR, because he wants to retribution.
Yeah, he absolutely wants what the USSR... I mean, remember, Putin is a guy that worked for the KGB in the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yep.
This man saw the disillusionment of his empire and now wants nothing more than to bring that back.
Which is crazy.
Which is a crazy thing to want, but at the same time...
I wish I could have been his mother.
Poem.
Who is it by?
The girl on 90210. I don't know her name.
That's probably a good thing. But if you want to hear just the worst possible response, there's a poem by this woman who's on 90210 where she starts it out by going, "Dear Putin, I wish I could have been your mom." And it doesn't get better.
It does not get better.
It doesn't get better. Poetry is art, Ben. You can't be... No.
Nope. It was not art this time.
No. Some art should not.
Also, you know? Just to wrap up on a good news, we're going to talk about two wars. We're going to talk about the first Crimean War, and we're going to talk about we're going to talk about the first Chechen War, and then we're going to talk about the Winter War.
Isn't it called Crimea?
Crimea? Depends on what your accent is, to be completely honest.
Cool.
And anyway, the Winter War happened in the 1940s. It was when Nazi Germany was a thing, and everybody seems to forget that the USSR had a treaty with Nazi Germany where they both invaded Poland, and like, Russia was only the good guys in the end of World War II because they got invaded too. Like, they were horrible to start with. They were cool with everything until they got invaded, because they split up Poland in half. And if you remember from history, when the Nazis took over where the Russians had like run through Poland, they were abhorred at what they saw. The Nazis were like, "This is too much," and that should tell you everything you need to know. At one point,
scary.
Yeah, very scary. At one point, the USSR decides, well, you know what? We want Finland, and so they go invade tiny little Finland. And
is this the one where the guy got high on all of the?
Yes, that's the meth guy, and also the best sniper in the world named Simo Haiha, who just. This guy killed 535 people with his rifle. He didn't, like, by the way, this isn't like a 3-month period. He did that without a scope. He was like, "I'm way better with iron sights. And also, it'll cause glint if they see it."
Sometimes,
I don't want that.
Sometimes, I'll be honest with you, sometimes iron sights are nicer.
That makes sense. Well, because they don't.
It depends on the rifle that he had, because I trained with an M16 A4.
He had a Russian Mosin Nagant, so he used a Russian gun to. It was so satisfying for him.
The bruise on his shoulder's collarbone after four of those kills.
Plus, he was 5'3".
I don't know what they're talking about.
He was
about.
A very big guy.
A Russian Mosin Nagant is just it's a big rifle, and it has a big kickback on it.
It's not gentle when you shoot it.
No, absolutely not. It definitely, he was in pain after 500 and whatever in 3 months. He could not feel his arm.
Wait, you get a bruised shoulder. I mean, it makes sense. That's just why I honestly think I would not survive in war. I'd be like, my shoulder's hurt. I shot one thing and it's been like really bad. I think I need to go home.
They would just give you a mounted gun after that. Oh. So you could just sit there with your hands up on the button.
Let me pull up real quick. So in the Winter War happens.
What's the maximum effective point range of a Russian Mosin Nagant?
Let me pull that up as well.
I'll pull that one up. You look up your thing.
Yeah, give me effective range of the Mosin Nagant. So the Winter War.
In the meantime.
Maximum.
In the meantime, Dan.
I'll stare at you.
Will be Dan.
I have nothing to look up. I'm just like, wow.
So just to clarify, I'm just going to read you out some force numbers for the invasion of Finland by the Russians. They did a surprise attack. They launched with either 425,000 to 760,000 troops. They went in with 2,500 to 6,500 tanks and 3,800 aircraft. The Finnish had 300,000 troops. They had 32 tanks and they had 114 aircraft. They went up against literally tanks wise almost 100 times, or if not double that. And then aircraft wise, quite literally 38 times as many. And here's the thing, they freaking won.
Wow.
They dominated. The Finns lost 25,904 dead or missing. The Russians lost anywhere from 125,000 to 167,000 dead or missing.
Yep.
43,000 were wounded by the Finns. 188 to 207,000 were wounded by the Russians. Wow. Or like just, they lost almost all their tanks. The Finns did. And half of their aircraft. But man, they lost... The Russians
lost half of their aircraft.
Yeah, well, because that's only 62.
Sorry. Okay.
But the Russians, they lost 1,200 to 3,500 tanks because the Finns had this gun. It was called the Lotti anti tank gun.
They used to put the moped.
Yes, well, kind of. So the moped's hilarious, but they used to put this one on skis
and ski it around
the mountains and then fire at tanks, blowing them up, and then
while
just going
meth.
Back. Like
while taking meth.
The maximum effective firing range of the Mosin Nagant is 500 meters. With optics, it's 800 plus meters. But he was not using optics.
No, he wasn't.
But still, 500 meters is still farther than the M16 A4.
Wow.
With iron sights, it's 300 meters.
That makes sense.
Crazy.
Gosh, the Simo-Hi-Ho was crazy. But anyway, the Finns, they did cede a little land in the end to the Russians, but at the end of the day, they kept their country, and they defended it against a just surprisingly outnumbering force. Now, another time that happened is the Crimean War. Dang it, I gotta quit saying Crimean. The Chechen War, the first Chechen War. There's been two Chechen Wars. The first Chechen War, I believe the capital of Chechnya is called Groznya, which I believe means trouble. It's a sad region in Russia that was like, we want to be our own.
Okay.
And then.
Hold on. I got it wrong. The maximum effective firing range, point firing range of the M16 rifle is 550 meters. But the maximum effective area range, so if you're just like spraying, it's 800.
Wow.
So the Mosin Nagant has a farther effective point range with optics.
Wow.
Because this doesn't change with optics. It just is 550 meters.
Crazy. That's interesting.
Wild. But you were saying, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good. I'm glad that we corrected that. With the first Chechen War, what happens is Chechnya wants to become its own country after the fall of the Soviet Union. And Russia will invade repeatedly. Mm. But Chechnya is a tiny little region in Russia that during the first Chechen War won. They became their own little nation state for a very brief period of time. And then unfortunately afterwards, the world pretty much supported them until the second Chechen War, where the Russians came in, were even more brutal. And unfortunately, the Chechen government started partnering with terrorists, like known terrorists. And that's when the world had to kind of back off. And that's an unfortunate thing that I don't think we're going to have to see with Ukraine moving forward is the partnering with, because they seem to be partnering with established countries and things like that, which seems to be very helpful. we can only, we don't know where the world is going right now, but we can only hope that this is one of those massive David and Goliath stories where Ukraine comes out on top. And right now they're doing an amazing job, and God, good luck to them, you know?
Well, I think that's the other thing that people underestimate. I think it's kind of interesting when countries invade other countries or happen to invade other countries. I don't think they account for...
willpower.
Well, yeah, willpower, but also national pride and the ideal of being able to keep freedom. Like, the idea that they thought that they could, like, Russia and Putin just thought that they could, like, go in and absolutely just have, like, this kind of easy... I don't know if they were necessarily expecting easy.
They were.
Well,
and they were wrong.
Kind of. And they were very wrong. And that's the, difference is that I don't think that people kind of take it into account, especially like even America's done it before, right? Mm-hmm. They assume that because their ideal is to them perfect, they can go and overtake a country or take out a piece of land or whatever it is, colonize. Mm-hmm. And literally every single time they or most of the time, those countries oftentimes conquer or win the war because they just manage to keep going. Like, they will keep fighting for that national ideal of just being able to say, we want to do what we want to do. We don't care about what other people's opinion. We don't want all of this extra, I don't know.
Well, we did that against Britain, the American Revolution.
And then
Britain
America was like, we should do this too, and did it to a whole bunch of other countries.
Yeah, well... some of my favorite stories from like the larger, from like the bigger wars, when you zoom in a little closer and you find just like, this is this one guy who was just so tired. He was just so tired. And then he killed 5,000 people because he was just so tired. Those are some of my favorite stories. Not that that's a great story. You should kill 5,000 people. But like when you look at just before the Civil War in America, you look at the story of John Brown. Mm-hmm. And one time, John Brown would just basically come in out of nowhere, out of the woods, and just murder slave owners and then set a bunch of slaves free and then disappear back into the woods.
Yeah,
That was like his whole MO. And then one time they captured two of his sons and they were like, this will stop him.
Spoiler alert. It did not stop
spoiler
him.
Spoiler alert. John Brown got a team of just 40 people.
Wow.
Walked into a city where they were training just like the slave owner army, basically. It was a city of 200 trained soldiers.
Yeah.
And he walked in there at night with 40 people, killed most of them, took a bunch captive, and lit the entire city on fire. And he only lost two people.
Wow.
And then as he was walking away, this is a direct quote, as he was walking away to the city that was on fire, somebody that he was with just like he wrote this letter to like his wife or whatever, and he's just like, yeah. So John Brown basically, after doing all this, just turned, looked at the fire, looked back forward, and went, God sees it, and then just kept walking.
Wow.
I also, I've got a legendary story about a guy named Ben L. Solomon, who I think will bring this a lot of joy. Very similar to that story. So he was a United States Army dentist during World War II. Mm-hmm. He was assigned as a frontline surgeon during the Battle of Saipan against the Japanese. And just to put into perspective, like, the Japanese will to fight in World War II has been unmatched compared to anything else we've ever seen in the entire world. I mean, like, we're talking about bonsai charges and things like that. And that's what started happening. In fact, his hospital was overrun. He was in a tent doing surgery. And then a Japanese soldier came in and he just shot two of them that had walked in and told the guard that was supposed to be watching him, leave. And then stands up the patient, sews him up, and goes, get out of here. And then when they found his body, he had been, I believe, shot 13 times, and he killed as many as 98 enemy troops before being killed. He just would not leave his tent. He was like, I will defend this tent for the rest of my life. And so he just stood there, letting everyone else escape, and by himself killed 98 people. And those are just the ones that we found that were close to his body.
Wow.
That were just close. It's absolutely... He's only one of three dental officers to ever receive the Medal of Honor. And just, like... He was a dentist! He just got so sick of teeth that he was like, I will kill everyone. Like, I mean, it's just insane.
He's like, I'm sick and tired of the state of people's teeth here.
I got one. Benny G. Adkins. You reminded me of this guy.
Yeah.
Let me read to you the citation for the Medal of Honor. Sergeant First Class Benny G. Adkins distinguished himself by acts of gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty while serving as an intelligent sergeant with Detachment A-102, 5th Special Forces Group, 1st Special Forces during combat operations against an armed enemy at Camp A Shao, Republic of Vietnam, from March 9th to 12th, 1966. When the camp was attacked by a large Vietnamese and Viet Cong force in the early morning hours, Sergeant First Class Adkins rushed through the intense enemy fire and manned a mortar position, continually adjusting fire for the camp, despite incurring wounds as the mortar pit received several direct hits from enemy mortars. Upon learning that several soldiers were wounded near the center of camp, he temporarily turned the mortar over to another soldier, ran through exploding mortar rounds, and dragged several comrades to safety. As the hostile fire subsided, Sergeant First Class Adkins exposed himself to sporadic sniper fire while carrying his wounded comrades to the camp dispensary. When Sergeant First Class Adkins and his group of defenders came under heavy small arms fire from members of the civilian irregular defense group that had defected to fight with the North Vietnamese, he maneuvered outside the camp to evacuate a seriously wounded American and draw fire, all the while successfully covering the rescue. When a resupply airdrop landed outside of the camp perimeter, Sergeant First Class Adkins again moved outside of the camp walls to retrieve the much-needed supplies. During the early morning hours of March 10, 1966, enemy forces launched their main attack, and within 2 hours, Sergeant First Class Adkins was the only man firing a mortar weapon. When all mortar rounds were expended, Sergeant First Class Adkins began placing effective recoilless rifle fire upon enemy positions. Despite receiving additional wounds from enemy rounds exploding on his position, Sergeant First Class Adkins fought off intense waves of attacking Viet Cong. Sergeant First Class Adkins eliminated numerous insurgents with small arms fire after withdrawing to a communications bunker with several soldiers. Running extremely low on ammunition, he returned to the mortar pit, gathered vital ammunition, and ran through an intense fire back to the bunker. After being ordered to evacuate the camp, Sergeant First Class Adkins and a small group of soldiers destroyed all signal equipment and classified documents, dug their way out of the rear of the bunker, and fought their way out of the camp. While carrying a wounded soldier to the extraction point, he learned that the last helicopter had already departed. Sergeant First Class Adkins led the group while evading the enemy until they were rescued by helicopter 2 days later on March 12, 1966. During the 38-hour battle and 48 hours of escape and evasion, fighting with mortars, machine guns, recoilless rifles, small arms, and hand grenades, it was estimated that Sergeant First Class Adkins killed between 135 and 175 of the enemy while sustaining 18 different wounds to his body. Sergeant First Class Adkins' extraordinary heroism and selflessness above and beyond the call of duty are in keeping with the highest tradition of the military service and reflect great credit upon himself, Detachment A-102, 5th Special Forces Group, 1st Special Forces, and the United States Army.
Wow, crazy.
Oh my God. Have you ever heard the story of Roy Benavidez?
I don't think so.
just know that this guy was the most, and I'm going to sum it up, like, he's the most legendary human being I think I've ever heard of in my entire life. He at one point, like, suffered a massive back injury while he was, like, in the military in Vietnam, by the way. And he ends up, like, they were like, you're never going to walk again. He was like, not only am I going to walk again, but I'm going to lead some special forces units because that's what I do.
Hell yeah.
And he started doing that. This is his Medal of Honor citation. He was essentially distinguished himself by a series of very extremely valorous actions while assigned detachment B-56, 5th Special Forces Group, 1st Special Forces. Essentially, a 12-man Special Forces reconnaissance team was inserted by helicopters to help exfil a whole bunch of people that things had gone completely awry, yeah. It was not good. What is it? Snafu? Situation normal?
Yeah. Yep.
This area was controlled and routinely patrolled by the North Vietnamese Army, and after a short period of time on the ground, the team met heavy fire and resistance. So they're loading up helicopters. Roy Benavidez is like, well, better grab some medication. So he grabs, like, a med pack, essentially, mm-hmm. and then a knife. And then he boards that helicopter because his men need him. And he'd heard them over the radio getting just annihilated. And so he's like, I'll go get him. And so he gets on the helicopter. And yeah, he did. He went and he got him. So essentially, he goes to the forward operating base where these helicopters had essentially landed. He returns and offloads wounded crew. He just keeps going. He's shot. I want to say, how many times did he get shot? Reaching the team's position, he was wounded in his right leg, face, and head. Though, despite these painful injuries, he took charge, repositioning the team members and directing their fire. He was literally taking wounded people and setting them up like army men to be able to keep fire downrange so they could keep the NVA off them.
Wow.
He then threw smoke canisters to direct aircraft. He carried and dragged half the wounded team members to the awaiting aircraft. He then provided protective fire by running alongside the aircraft as it moved. He was picking up weapons at this point.
Oh, yeah.
As the enemy's fire intensified, he hurried to recover the body and classified documents on a dead team leader, which was his friend and who he was actually going back for. Wow. And he found him dead. And I guess that's...
Okay, Forrest Gump.
He really did Forrest Gump this whole thing. When he honestly, I think that it's based off Benavidez. Like these some of the particular moments.
Based off of what you're saying right now.
Yeah.
The guy who kept running back in to save more wounded people.
Yeah. When he reached the leader's body, Sergeant Benavidez was severely wounded by small arms fire in the abdomen and a grenade fragments in his back. At nearly the same moment, the aircraft pilot was mortally wounded and his helicopter crashed. Although in extremely critical condition due to his multiple wounds, Sergeant Benavidez secured the classified documents, made his way back to the wreckage, where he aided the wounded out of the overturned aircraft, gathered the stunned survivors into a defensive perimeter again. Under increasing enemy automatic weapons and grenade fire, he moved around the perimeter, distributing water and ammunition to everyone. In them and just help them try reinstilling in them the will to live and fight. Facing a buildup of enemy opposition with them, the beleaguered team, Sergeant Benavidez mustered his strength, began calling in tactical airstrikes and directing the fire of supporting gunships to suppress the enemy's fire. He was wounded again by small arms fire while administering first aid to a wounded team member. This guy never gave himself any medication, by the way. He was like, well, I need to be focused and sharp.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this dude was insane. Wounded team member just before another extraction helicopter was able to land. His indomitable spirit kept him fighting, and he continued to ferry his comrades to the craft. On his second trip with the wounded, he was clubbed from behind by an enemy soldier in an ensuing hand-to-hand combat. He sustained additional wounds to his head and arms before killing his adversary. He was just clubbed. He then continued under devastating fire to carry wounded to the helicopter. Upon reaching the aircraft, he spotted and killed two enemy soldiers who were rushing the craft from an angle that prevented the aircraft door's gunner from being able to fire upon them. With little strength remaining, he made one last trip to ensure the perimeter and ensure that all classified material had been collected or destroyed, bringing the remaining wounded in there. Couple things that make this even more insane. When he gets to the home base, essentially, he is helicoptered back in. They zip him up in a body bag because they think he's dead. Because he's been shot so many times.
He's just taking a nap.
Right before they finished zipping him up, he spat on the doctor's face. He was like, I'm still alive. And that's how they knew to start giving him medical attention. Was he spat at the doctor. He was like, hey, this is crap. Like, literally, don't. What you're doing right now, don't do it. And that's where Benavidez
is. It is warm, though. You can just keep... Just zip it up real quick. I'm going to take a nap.
No nap for you.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Wild. What an intense episode.
Yeah, that got really intense.
Yeah. If there's one thing that you got to take away out of this is there's always some good somewhere.
Yes.
There's always a silver lining. You just got to take the time to find it. And although some things kind of seem sucky right now, they're not always going to be sucky. We'll get there.
And we can only hope to do our best to be part of the good and be part of the part that is making it not sucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't make it sucky. Anyway, that's the episode. Thanks for watching. We hope we did something or said something that makes you want to tune in next week. If you want to find us outside of the podcast, Ryan, where can they find you?
YouthPastorRyan.com.
Dan?
Dan Bam Bam on all social media except for Snapchat, which is Dan_YOLO_love.
And you can find me at BenBrainerd.com. Last name is spelled brain, like the one in your head, A-R-D. If you can't figure that out, try using yours. The podcast also has a website. It's GDFMPodcast.com. You can contact us by emailing podcast@GDFMPodcast.com. That's it. That's all. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye.